not perfect, but in this instance, I think the cops were trying to do the best they could.
An arrest video of a native teenager in Sitka goes viral from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 2nd. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Secretary of Defense discusses Alaska troop reductions with Army personnel in Fairbanks.
The Army has decided that it's better strategically to use its funding elsewhere.
Tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council promotes local fishermen and seafood caught by Alaskans for Alaskans. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
Sitka police are defending their actions in the arrest of an 18-year-old man last year who was tasered multiple times in his jail cell. A Sitka teacher over the weekend posted a video showing the arrest of a native high school student. The video has circulated widely on social media. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
It's not pretty to watch. Sitka Police Chief Sheldon Schmidt is candid about that.
I think any time the police are using force, it can be upsetting.
Schmidt says he reviewed the video shortly after the arrest of Franklin Hugendorn in September 2014. It shows two officers and a jailer escorting Hugendorn into a Sitka jail cell, handcuffed behind his back, stripping him down to his underwear, and tasering him multiple times in the thigh while holding his arms and legs together behind his back in a move that is sometimes called hog-tying. But Schmidt says this isn't the whole story.
What you're seeing on the video is a culmination of a longer contact.
Schmidt says the scene in the jail cell began earlier in the evening on the sidewalk in front of a Sitka bar where the underage Hugendorn had been trying to buy drinks. Schmidt says Hugendorn was combative when officers initially approached him, and the struggle continued as he was taken into custody.
You can't see him fighting back. According to the officers, he was resisting in the jail cell. He was using his arms and his legs to not comply, and he was doing so with force. The officer mentioned several times that he's a very strong young man.
The video was posted by Alexander Allison, a middle school teacher in Sitka, who obtained it from a defense attorney. The treatment of Hugendorn struck a nerve because he had a similar encounter with Sitka police a few months later. Allison submitted a commentary to KCAW describing his arrest in February while observing officers conduct a drunk driving investigation on a friend, also outside a bar.
Without being charged, without being read my rights, without being given a phone call, I was handcuffed, taken into custody, placed in a cell, stripped naked, given a concussion, and held until late the following morning. After being released, I was not arraigned for 7 weeks. My arrest wasn't recorded in the local police blotter. Appearing in court, the district attorney pulled me aside, apologized for the circumstances, and offered to dismiss my charges of drunk and disorderly conduct and criminal mischief for my behavior after my arrest. Though not physically resisting, I did not go quietly.
Allison posted the proposed radio commentary along with the video in social media. The commentary is under review by a broadcasting attorney because it alleges that two of the three officers in the Hugendorn arrest had been involved in previous disciplinary action for excessive use of force. Sitka Police Chief Sheldon Schmidt says that one officer disciplined for using a taser against a man in Roswell, New Mexico, who subsequently died, was cleared of any wrongdoing along with his fellow officers at the time. Schmidt says the allegations against the second Sitka officer involved in a shooting have also been taken out of context. But context doesn't necessarily resolve one other aspect of this incident. In the video, after the three officers leave Hugendorn prone and immobile on a plastic pad, stripped to his underwear, one of them utters a slur. It's not racial, but it's unprofessional. Sheldon Schmidt.
It is, and we don't want guys to say stuff like that, but that will give you some insight into how he's feeling at the time, that this was uncomfortable for them, and they felt like the guy was not cooperating at all with them. In fact, he was fighting them.
KCAW attempted to reach Franklin Hugendorn, but his phone wasn't taking messages. Alexander Allison, again in his commentary, says he thinks police in Sitka have crossed a line.
If a teacher and a native teenager can have their constitutional rights so grievously violated, then it could happen to anyone. Your son or daughter, your husband or wife, your best friend who might have been out at a bar or was pulled over for a failure to signal a turn. I know there are many good law enforcement officers here, and they play an important and necessary role. I'm proud to say I have taught their children. But there has been a dangerous shift in department protocol, and this needs to be addressed.
Chief Schmidt says his department has worked ceaselessly to build bridges in the community. He's willing to talk about this topic with anyone. He also concedes that things could have been different.
We're not perfect, but in this instance, I think the cops were trying to do the best they could. Could they have handled it differently? Yes. And probably in a way that wasn't so negative looking. You know, I think they could have just simply backed out of the jail cell at that point when he's refusing to comply with what they wanted him to do.
Schmidt says he's been considering body cameras long before they became a high-profile subject nationally. More video will help us, he says. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
A hearing to reconsider the murder convictions of the Fairbanks Four is beginning a fifth week. The marathon proceeding is to hear new testimony about the 1997 beating death of 15-year-old John Hartman in downtown Fairbanks, a crime George Freese, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent were convicted of. They're requesting exoneration, largely based on identification of alternate suspects, including former Fairbanks resident Jason Wallace. KUAC's Dan Ross reports.
Jason Wallace allegedly made self-incriminating statements in 2003 about the Hartman murder before being tried for an unrelated drug killing. More recently, former drug ring partner William Holmes, who's also serving time for other murders, confessed involvement in the Hartman attack, pinning the actual beating on Wallace. Wallace has been granted immunity from prosecution in exchange for testifying at the Fairbanks 4 hearing. But under questioning by State Attorney Adrian Bachman, Wallace, who was a high school student at the time of the attack, denied even knowing about it.
You lived in Fairbanks, Alaska in 1997.
Yes, I did.
How was it that you didn't hear about the John Hartman homicide?
It wasn't something I kept up with. I didn't keep up with, stuff like that.
Wallace has appeared as a witness for state attorneys working to uphold the convictions of the Fairbanks Four. Bachman reminded Wallace that he was under oath, then proceeded with specific questions about the Hartman attack.
Were you on the corner of 9th and Barnett when John Hartman was attacked?
No, I was not.
Were you driving a car near the corner of 9th and Barnett when John Hartman was attacked?
No, I was not.
This is important stuff, sir. We need your honest testimony here. Did you have any involvement in that attack?
No, I did not.
As a driver?
No, ma'am.
The last response is specifically contradictory to Wallace's chronicled statement to a public defender agency employee in 2003, in which he claimed to have driven a car carrying Holmes and other men who got out and assaulted Hartman. Others have testified that Wallace told them about the attack in preceding days. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The United States Secretary of Defense says Alaska is geographically important to meet growing threats in the Pacific theater. Ash Carter stopped in Fairbanks Friday on his way to Korea for security meetings. While in our state, he met with personnel from Eielson Air Force Base and Fort Wainwright. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, Carter says funding cuts would likely reduce the level of armed forces stationed in Alaska.
Ash Carter met briefly and addressed service members from Fort Wainwright and Eielson Air Force Base Friday. He told them their work was important to the country and emphasized the strategic importance Alaska plays in global peacekeeping. He then took questions from the audience. One service member wanted to know if Alaska was strategically critical, why were Army units being cut? Carter partly blamed funding gridlock in Washington, but also acknowledged priorities were shifting away from counterinsurgency wars called coin wars.
Those of you in the Army know that the Army is reducing its size. A lot of that reduction has to do with the end of the coin wars. The Army has decided that it's better strategically to use its funding elsewhere.
What Carter didn't seem as prepared to address were questions from service members about sexual assault and suicide. He told those gathered sexual assault was fundamentally against the military's code of honor and would not be tolerated. And while acknowledging the rising number of suicides in the armed forces was disturbing, Carter broadened the context of the discussion to include American culture as a whole.
I'd be proud if we figured out suicide in a way that was helpful not only to our own members who are having that problem, but to society as a whole.
Carter says he admires the military's ability to take on problems once they're identified. The defense secretary next day was on to meetings in South Korea, where, among other topics, he took up China's growing military presence in the South China Sea. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Tagalog language radio show in Juneau connects kids to their roots.
I hope that they listen to teenagers. It's good to know your own, your mother's language, you know, or your father's language.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Slick ice and a dusting of new snow made commuting on the Glen Highway treacherous this morning. Alaska State Troopers responded to 31 vehicle incidents on the Glen in their Matanuska Valley jurisdiction today, according to spokesperson Megan Peters. Anita Schell with the Anchorage Police Department said since midnight, Anchorage police responded to 87 collisions and more than 90 vehicles in distress throughout APD's jurisdiction. 10 involved non-life-threatening injuries. APD patrols the Glen Highway from the Knik River Bridge to the city. Wasilla to Anchorage commuter and Alaska News Nightly engineer Ron Zastro said his normal 50-minute drive time was stretched to 3 hours.
Yeah, everybody that I saw on the southbound lanes was driving slow. I didn't see as many vehicles in the ditch as I thought I was going to see.
Another thing Zastro didn't see, sand trucks heading south.
There was no sand on the highway that I saw.
The Glen is a priority one traffic artery, according to Jill Reese with the State Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Reese says DOT's sand trucks went to work at 5 a.m., although the trucks go where they are most needed and not tied to any particular route.
It's normal Alaska winter ice, so people sometimes forget how to drive on this ice when, you know, we first get hit every year. It's the same.
Reese says DOT's budget has been cut by 25% along with other state agency budgets due to the current state fiscal shortfall, and that reduction has been felt in materials the department uses, such as sand. She says even if the road is sanded, that doesn't solve all the traffic woes.
It's not DOT's practice, even in years past, to sand the entire length of a highway. We sand the approaches, the curves, the intersections, those sorts of things. We rely on motorists to drive for the conditions of the road, and we will put sand on those areas as we can.
Reese says the road conditions are worsened when warm tires melt the ice and then it freezes again, creating a continuous cycle of ice and thaw. After 2.5-week closure, on Alaska's Museum of the Aleutians is once again open to the public, but an allegation of theft against the museum's director has triggered mudslinging, a shakeup on the board of directors, and distress among those who have contributed items to the museum's collection. KUCB's Greta Mart reports.
On Wednesday, the museum's board of directors reinstated Executive Director Zoya Johnson from paid administrative leave. Johnson's been the museum's director for 11 years and also sits on the Unalaska City Council. The board put Johnson on leave and closed the museum after a 19th century Russian Orthodox Bible and two other religious books from the museum's collection were found in her house in September. The items had apparently been there since 2009.
Credibility of this museum has been damaged.
Unalashka Corporation Chair Vince Tudyakov Sr. questioned whether Native people could entrust the Museum of the Aleutians with their artifacts.
Some of our families here do have stuff in that museum that we share with the public. I'm very concerned about that. They said there was an investigation done, that there was no wrongdoing. The policies, the procedures were broken.
After the books were found in Johnson's house, the museum's board says it conducted an internal investigation into allegations Johnson had stolen the books for her own use, and that the investigation proved those allegations untrue. By a vote of 5-2, the board decided to return the keys to the museum to Johnson, and they voted to reprimand Johnson for, quote, the breach in collections protocol, according to a press release issued Thursday morning by board secretary Melissa Good. The museum board also directed Johnson to write a letter of apology to the community. When the board closed the museum on October 12th, it also voted to seek outside counsel on how to handle the situation. They consulted Scott Carley at Alaska State Museums and Museums Alaska President Jane Lindsay. At this week's meeting, Board Secretary Good read out the advice the board received from Lindsay.
Lindsay said that we should consider the services that Zoya has rendered so far, and based on these services, we should be fair to Zoya first.
Board member Susie Golodoff said while the board should be fair to Johnson, the stewardship of the museum's collection entails the highest public trust.
This isn't about Zoya. This is about our museum, and we have clear duties and clear responsibilities.
Unalaska Mayor Shirley Marquardt encouraged the board to reopen the museum. She said it had a statewide reputation as a well-run and professional institution.
That doesn't happen, you know, on a whim. That happens when you have very good set processes and procedures. Was one process not followed? Looks like it wasn't. Who knows? There's a lot of open questions there.
The board plans to have the two outside experts, Carley and Lindsay, review the museum's written policies. Lindsay says the American Alliance of Museums Code of Ethics specifies that personal use of museum collections for any reason is not permitted.
I would say what is always very important in situations like this is, has trust been broken beyond repair? And what does that mean? And then also, what are now your safeguards so that it does not happen again? What is the institution now putting in place so that trust can be regained and rebuilt?
Reporting in Unalaska, I'm Greta Mart.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by BP Alaska, as part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
For nearly a decade, Alaska Bulk Water Incorporated has been setting up shop in Sitka at the site of the city's once pulp mill. The former bottling company is trying to send raw water to customers around the world, from drought-stricken California to beer manufacturers in Mexico. Not a single drop has been exported so far, but the Sitka Assembly is offering the company another chance to deliver on its promises. At the company's request, the Sitka Assembly last week agreed to extend their contract for the sixth time. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
With this extension, Alaska Bulk will have 36 more months to export Sitka's most abundant natural resource. The company, formerly called True Alaska Bottling, drew up a purchase agreement with the city in 2006. As the venture slowly took shape, the company requested and was awarded 5 deadline extensions. And on Tuesday, Terry Trapp, the CEO of Alaska Bulk Water, asked the assembly for yet another grace period.
Moving water from Alaska to other parts of the world sounds easy, but it isn't. We've spent 9 years in a learning curve and understanding the things that we have to do in order to make this happen.
And in the past 3 years, a lot of the grunt work has happened on the supply side. Alaska Bulk Water spent $1.5 million on a new water station on the tidelands of the Gary Paxson Industrial Park. The company also bought 12,000 feet of floating pipeline, purchased a tidelands lease to allow ships into Silver Bay, and installed a dual mooring buoy system for anchoring those ships, which are too large to dock. Over the years, Alaska Bulk has also paid the city $1.35 million in non-refundable credits to hold on to the contract. With this extension, the company is shelling out another $1 million. Assemblymember Matthew Hunter said that swayed his vote 3 years ago and clinches his vote now.
We're looking at another $1 million we get whether you ship water or not. That's a lot of pressure on you. You're already $1.3 million plus your infrastructure and all the other stuff for marketing and stuff. It's got to be a big investment. So I trust that your goal here is to ship water and to pay us for it. So sounds good. Right now it's pouring over the dam, so it's not doing us any good.
Hunter said, worst case scenario, Alaska Bulk Water asked for another extension in 3 years. Best case scenario, water business is booming in 3 years. Assemblymember Bob Petruski was a bit more skeptical. He thought it wasn't prudent to lock out competitors. With the contract amendment, Alaska Bulk will have access to 92% of Sitka's commercial water and plans to sell it for 1 cent a gallon.
Personally, I would like to see this contract for significantly less water. And I would get rid of the whole idea of exclusivity. And I would give others the opportunity to come in and see what they can do with Sitka's water.
Trapp responded by saying that there wasn't enough space in Silver Bay for multiple companies to build their own loading stations, and that when it comes to marketing water, customers prefer to see one salesman.
You have one product to sell. That's water. Okay. You can't differentiate it. It's bulk water. The only, if you introduce competition, it's going to wind up in a competitive battle and a downward pressure on price. We're holding the line at a penny a gallon as to what we have to pay for the with the city. And I know that other people would like to come in here and offer you less and promise you that they can deliver the whole world. And that's just not reality.
The assembly seemed convinced, throwing their weight behind the company in the hope they will literally deliver. Trapp said he'll be shifting gears these next 3 years to focus on the demand side of bulk water. He claims the company has potential customers in Mexico, the Middle East, China, and South America. Alaska Bulk also has a corporate office in Seattle and is marketing directly to Southern California. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
More than 26,000 Filipino people live in Alaska, and one Juno DJ is finding ways to connect others with their culture on the airwaves. KTOL reporter Elizabeth Jenkins stopped by KRNN for a night of Filipino duets.
Ayan mga kaibigan, kumusta? Kumusta kayong lahat? Ang ating programang Magandang Gabi.
In the 2 years that Ginny Del Rosario has been hosting Good Evening, My Friends, she's only been absent once, and that was because her car wouldn't start. In the summer, she closes her Filipino food shack early to make sure she's here on time. The winter months, she says, are the hardest. It's dark, the roads are slick with ice, and it's cold.
But I have to be here, you know? It doesn't matter, because it's like I have my alarm for this show, 9 o'clock. Even if I'm like lying down, I said, 30 minutes before I have to come over now. Sometimes I'm rushing. It's like I'm in the car doing something. Oh, I gotta go.
So, kailan ka darating? Pakinggan natin yung kanta ni Wency Cornejo and Raquel, Rachel Alejandro. Ito po mga kaibigan.
During the breaks, she reads Tagalog. The root language of the Philippines has multiple dialects. Del Rosario can speak five. She reads public service announcements, Filipino recipes, newsletters, even birthdays. In the summer, she fills the gaps with stories from cruise visitors, usually other Filipinos who work on the ships. She started the show because she felt like her community wasn't being represented.
You know, it's a shame that, we have a second largest minority and we don't have, you know, our own show to showcase our tradition.
Ako'y nakakapasupagsina.
Anthony Castello is one singer that when I was in college, we used to scream like the Beatles. Oh, he's so handsome. It's like Beaver fans, you know, or you go crazy, you know, or Jonas, or Justin Bieber, or Joe Jonas. Anthony Castello was like that before.
When she visits her family in the Philippines, she brings back CDs. In Juno, she says it's impossible to find the music. iTunes and Spotify don't have a great selection. And like the food, she says the songs from her home can trigger memories. Good Evening, My Friends is for people who immigrated to the States, but also for their kids who might not have grown up speaking Tagalog.
I hope that they listen, the teenagers. It's good to know your own, your mother's language, you know, or your father's language. I just missed that out with my children. I just wished before that I could have taught them how to speak Tagalog, you know, or I just... They told me every time they go home to the Philippines, they always say, Mom, why didn't you teach us how to speak Tagalog? Even just give us a dictionary or what? I didn't have time. I thought they weren't interested, but they were.
Del Rosario came to the U.S. on a Rotary International Scholarship and traveled around the country as an ambassador for the Philippines in the 80s. She went back, determined to return to the United States.
It was like my eyes was open and it's like... I was already 29, so I was ready to do adventure in the United States. My mama said, aren't you scared? No, Ma. I said, I'm 29 years old. What's going to go wrong?
She met her now ex-husband, settled in Vegas. She was able to stay in the country with a green card and thought she'd stay in Vegas forever. Then the marriage split up. She needed a fresh start.
Came to Juneau with just two suitcases. It was difficult for me the first 6 months. It's like I was a homeless person living from one friend to another friend's house.
Eventually, she opened a daycare. That led to the funds to open Manila Bay Cafe with her sibling.
I used the store's income to send my children to college.
Del Rosario is visiting the Philippines in December, and she says it's not easy to find a sub for the show. So far, her attempts to recruit someone who speaks Tagalog have failed. But that doesn't mean she's giving up. When she does return home, she'll collect more music for her show and mourn with family. Recently, a sister passed away.
Even though when my sister died 3 weeks ago, I don't feel like coming, but... I said the show must go on, and you know, my sister would be proud. And I'll be back Tuesday night po, 9 to 11. Ito po inyong lingkod, si Miss Jenny Del Rosario, and yung host nating programang Magandang Gabi, Kaibigan.
In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Robert Woolsey and Emily Kwonk in Sitka, Dan Bross and Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Greta Mart in Unalaska, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Ron Sastro. Monica.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
The University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.